It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new 20-bed shelter for people experiencing homelessness in Menominee is years in the making. But the Karen House in western Wisconsin is already faced with demands that exceed its capabilities. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Heidi Hooten is shelter manager for Stepping Stones of Dunn County. Heidi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So
happy to be here.
Yes, Stepping Stones operates three apartment-style shelters for people experiencing homelessness, and you manage them, including the new 20-bed shelter, which opened last fall. How is the community responding to the new facility?
Dunn County is really quite amazing in their support for our homeless folk. We don't have the kind of problem where you see people panhandling or being on the street, but we invite the public in to the shelters to help us out because we are always seeking volunteers, and the support for it has been amazing.
You opened Karen House and had a waiting list from the outset. What is the situation like today?
Today, the waiting list for Karen House is about 37 individuals. We get calls almost every day. We've had to cap the wait list. It's so long at this point. I maintain a wait list for folks exiting jail, prison, and treatment to try to get those folks, back into the community. But it's not enough, but it's what we have. So, and it's going quite well.
Why is the wait list so long?
I think since the pandemic, we've seen a great increase in homelessness. Most of our folks have significant barriers, criminal background, evictions on record, poor credit. And the housing market here in Dunn County and really all over the United States is so tight that it's really difficult for people to find housing in the first place at all levels of income. It doesn't matter if you're homeless or you have a really good income, it's hard to find housing.
So can you explain the setup of the shelter? It's, I understand, individual rooms, their own bath. What is it like?
Yeah, there's 20 rooms. They're small. Everybody gets their own small bedroom and bathroom. We did that intentionally. We didn't want to have shared shower space. A lot of our folks have trauma, and to try to monitor that is really difficult. So we wanted to give them the dignity and privacy of their own space. There's a shared dining room. We have a resource center where folks from the community can come in and meet with them. We have workforce resource come in for those folks looking for work. We have some peer support specialists come in to meet with people. And we have the ability to do classes in that room, which is really nice. Monday through Thursday, we have four churches in our community that provide community meals, and they deliver meals to us Monday through Thursday for dinner. And then we have volunteers from the community come in Friday through Sunday who come in and make meals at the shelter.
So it really feels like you've been able to bring many different types of services together all in one place. So people aren't trying to go all over, perhaps more of a rural area to figure out what are those next steps.
Right. Transportation is a huge issue in a small community. We have a bus line, but it doesn't run at all the hours that people work. If you work a second shift, you may be able to get there on bus, but you can't get back on bus. So that poses a lot of difficulty. We're very close to a lot of the resources that our folks use. So, location was a big thing for us when we were planning to build the shelter.
We're talking about the Karen House. This is a new apartment-style homeless shelter in western Wisconsin. Heidi Hooten is a shelter manager with Stepping Stones of Dunn County. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Heidi, I've been reflecting on the name Karen House, and I just want to acknowledge it because Karen being that heap of stones piled up as a landmark, it can mean, you know, marking hiking routes in parks. Can you talk about the name choice?
Yeah, you know, it's a way, a cairn is a way of marking your path. Mm-hmm. And plus it tied in with stepping stones, which, you know, went into, we threw around a lot of names before we settled on that.
Where do people live while waiting for an apartment?
We have folks, a lot of folks living in their vehicles. A lot of our folks are couch surfing. We still have, you know, some people that are in institutions waiting to be released. Some people in their storage facilities, you know, occasionally people will be outside. Yeah, they're just wherever they can be to try to get out of the cold as much as they can.
Is it difficult to maintain contact with people on the waiting list?
It is, because a lot of times when people are homeless, they might have phones that you have to put minutes on. And so their phones aren't always working, or they lose their phones. And it can be really hard to maintain contact with our folks. So a lot of times when we start going through our list and start calling people, we'll get a lot of people who have fallen off simply because we can't get a hold of them.
And then what happens? Do you try to figure out where they are, or do you go to the next person on the list? What happens?
We just go to the next person on the list, and a lot of times they will resurface at some point in time. So it's just kind of, we just wait to hear back from them.
Is Stepping Stones considered a dry facility, meaning no alcohol or drug use?
We are... I guess you would call us a hybrid. So we're not a walk-in facility. You know, we're working off a wait list. And when a person first comes in for intake, if they're drunk or high, we won't let them in. But if during their stay, they come in and are drunk or high, we will pull them aside and have a conversation with them. We want to try to give them another opportunity to get sober, so we work through a strike system. So after three strikes, you know, if it continues, we have to have them leave. We have a lot of people in recovery in our shelters, so mm-hmm. it's a balance of trying to keep people safe and keep people on the right track.
Let's bring on a caller, Dwayne in Westfield. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I'm living exactly what you're saying right now, but I live in a county where there's absolutely no help whatsoever. There's no housing, no nothing. You're pretty much on your own, and you basically fend for yourself. How can the lady that's working with in Dunn County get, however she got that done, how can she get this county to actually start doing something along those same lines? Because apparently this county doesn't seem to care whatsoever in Marquette County.
Dwayne, thank you for the call. You know, Heidi, what suggestions do you have to replicate this model?
Well, you know, that's a really good comment, because there are a lot of counties that don't have shelters. And I guess, you know, Stepping Stones has been around for quite a while. And we started our first shelter over 20 years ago, and that got started by a group of church people, actually, who got together and saw the need. And so they started the first apartment-style shelter that we have. So that's how that started, but it's bringing in both county folks and city folks to see the problem. One of the things we did in the last year, and I think this may have helped Karen House too, is we have a program called Health Done Right that was started by the health department. And one of the committees that I was on was a housing committee, because that was identified by people in the community as a major issue. And thanks to some of the funding that committee got, we got together with the county and the city and did a housing study. And when the housing study was published last year, it became very obvious that we had a very limited housing for folks, and that has started to get people a little more motivated to do something about the problem. But it is difficult, and it's hard to get people involved in it, if especially if you don't see that you actually have a housing problem. You know, you're not seeing homeless on the streets, so it is difficult to get all those people together.
You were able to really clearly show a connection between a lack of housing and a public health issue, as a public health
right.
issue. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Heidi Hooten is shelter manager for Stepping Stones of Dunn County. The Karen House is its latest 20-bed shelter. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We continue to further the conversation about homelessness in Wisconsin and learn about a new shelter in Menominee called Karen House, serving 20 individuals in western Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Heidi Hooten is shelter manager of Stepping Stones of Dunn County. Heidi, the Karen House received a $1.4 million state grant in 2022 to build the facility. Is this grant also funding operations?
It does not. We also had a capital campaign that raised an additional amount. So the total cost of the shelter was $1.7 million. It does not cover operations. We get a couple of state grants pretty routinely every year that helps with that. We're always on the search for grants. We get donations from private individuals and organizations. Funding is always a big issue for any shelter. And also, you know, we do a lot of our operations with volunteers. We have a small dedicated staff to the shelter. This last year, we got 4 AmeriCorps people that are working at the shelter, and then we fluff that out with volunteers. Volunteers are a necessary part of the operation, and it also, you know, when you bring volunteers in from the community, it helps get rid of that stigma that homelessness has, because once you know them, you grow to love them. So we try to bring in the community as much as possible.
In what capacity is AmeriCorps working, in your homeless shelter program?
They help us. They talk with we call them guests. They talk with the guests. They help us with food. We do serve breakfast and lunch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had never served food before, so that is still mind-boggling to me, how we're doing that. But they help us with every aspect of the shelter.
Why?
They've been a big bonus to us.
Yeah. Why focus on individuals and not families in your shelter program?
We found over the years that about 80% of the people calling in are individuals or couples. Mm-hmm. It isn't to say that they don't have children, but maybe the children aren't with them. So we get a lot more individuals calling us than we do families.
In terms of continuing operations at the level that you are, how critical are state grants and other forms of grant opportunities for your organization?
They're absolutely crucial. We can't operate without the generosity of the community, and we try for every grant that we can possibly apply for, and, you know, continue to apply for the state grants and anything that we can do to keep going.
solar panels are on the roof of the Karen House, and I understand it was a grant through Renew Wisconsin that promotes renewable energy, that nonprofit. How much do these solar panels reduce operating costs? What is the impact there?
Well, we're hoping that, we have 40 solar panels. The grant covered 20, and the rest were covered with donations. And they will actually produce more energy over the year than we will use. So we can sell that excess energy back to Xcel Energy at a wholesale rate.
Net metering.
And we're hoping, that it'll reduce our operating costs so that we can get more funding into programming.
Oh, wow. When did you make that decision to put solar on the roof? Was it in the design process? How did it come up?
I think it came about actually a little later after we applied the grant. We had a group of people that were interested in solar and had approached us about doing this. So Patrick Gallagher, who's our executive director, and the committee decided to pursue it. So with solar, you're expending more money at the on the onset, but it will reduce it as the years go by. So I think it was a good idea.
We're talking with Heidi Hooten, who is shelter manager at Stepping Stones of Dunn County, as we look at the work in the Karen House. This is a new apartment-style homeless shelter in western Wisconsin. Call in with questions. You can share your insights along the way at 800-642-1234. Heidi, Governor Tony Evers was on our program in October to discuss our state's response to homelessness, and the governor talked about using the state's expected budget surplus to better support shelters.
Well, we certainly have enough money left over in our budget that could be used for those services, and so hopefully the specter of that will increase the Republicans' interest in doing something to support the shelters in a better way. But we'll continue to do whatever we can using federal money to help the shelters out.
Heidi, what comes up for you as you hear the governor's response there?
Well, bless his heart. I hope that happens because, we're always looking for money sources. So that would be a big boon to all shelters. And I just want to point something out. Karen House is not apartment style. We have two family shelters that are apartment style, but Karen House is a communal shelter.
Communal. So. Okay. So technically that terminology, when it is a room and a bath, would be communal because you come together in that common area to provide support services, to provide food and other offerings. Is that
right?
Okay. At the point in time when people are ready to move on, I'm not sure how many days that is, but how do you ensure that that your guests have a stable home that they're going to?
Well, everybody that comes into the shelter is assigned a case manager, and the case manager will work with them on their goals. They set their own goals. Of course, everybody's goal is to get into housing. We work really hard we help them with applications. We're always online looking for openings. Not everybody leaves and goes into housing, unfortunately. Mainly because of the barriers that they have and the limited housing that's available. But we do our very best to try to make sure that they're going into a more permanent solution.
Let's bring in Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay, go ahead.
Yeah, I have experience with families that have been in homeless shelters. That's just, we need them. I understand that. We don't need more funding for them, though. We need funding for escrow and rent. Because people do not want to be taken care of. They want to take care of themselves. They want to be able to buy a house. They want to be able to get an apartment. So, again, we don't need more money spent on shelters.
What do you think, Heidi, of Mary Kay's perspective there?
Well, I agree with Mary Kay that we do need more funding for rent. And one of the programs that we have at Stepping Stones is a homelessness prevention program. We get money from the state to do that. And the person that does that in our office is trying to keep people in their homes or people that are paying for hotel stays on their own or couch surfing are also eligible for that program. I think the problem, though, is we work with a lot of folks who have mental health issues or addiction issues, both. They may have felonies on record or they have evictions on record. And while I wish it were true that Mary Kay says, you know, everybody wants to have their own home. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. The problem is that sometimes there's that space of time with people with significant barriers just simply can't find housing that will accept them. And that's where shelters come in. We cover that interim time while they're looking, because everybody deserves to have a home of their own, and everybody, you know, absolutely, we support that idea.
Heidi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Heidi Hooten is shelter manager at Stepping Stones of Dunn County. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We hear from a Milwaukee investigative journalist who probes the history of mob activity in her city and a car bombing that killed her cousin decades ago. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition.
Corn has been grown for thousands of years across North America, and tribes have been making different variations of corn soups for generations. WPR's Daniel Kading caught up with a Red Cliff tribal member who cooks a Potawatomi-style corn soup handed down from her husband's family. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is just take some of the meat off of the pork neck bones and put it back into the stock.
That's Sarah Gordon Altman, or Nagano Sekwe in Ojibwe. She's preparing a Potawatomi-style corn soup. The recipe comes from her husband's mother, and it's made with a white corn variety that comes from Walpole Island First Nation. It's home to a community of Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Ottawa in Canada.
I'll just get this meat cut up, and I'll show you the corn after that.
She's using a white dent corn that's made into hominy through nixtamalization. That's a process where kernels are cooked and steeped in an alkaline solution like calcium hydroxide, or lye. She says the corn is processed using hardwood ashes that contain a lye-like substance to help remove the outer hull.
And you can grind it, and that's what you make masa for, like tortillas and things like that out of. And when you do that, it actually makes it nutrient-rich and available for you. But if you just eat corn that's ground, you cannot get the nutrients out of it until it's nixtamalized.
Long ago, she says people would heat stones that had lime in them and add those to water, creating the right conditions to remove the corn's outer hull. She says that process was carried north from Mexico to tribes in the Midwest through trade routes.
So this food, this kind of corn soup idea, is something that crosses all over the continent. Like, it's a huge thing, but every different, you know, tribe has their own form of it. And so this is the Potawatomi way of doing it, basically.
On the stove, she sautés onions for the soup. On a back burner, navy beans and smoked meat simmer in a broth that she cooked for hours the night before. Typically, she and her husband make this soup in the fall, and she adds her own twist to the meal with homemade tortillas that are dipped in the dish.
Yeah, my kids last night when I started making the broth, they were like, "Are you making bacon? Is that bacon? What's that delicious smell?" I'm like, no, it's smoked meat. And they're like, "Oh, can we have some?" It's like, it's not ready yet.
She's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa on her dad's side. That's where her father grew up. She says he and her husband gravitated to these large soups.
Naboop is what we call it in Ojibwe. And it's something that you would use all winter long because a lot of our ingredients were dried. Like manumin would have, wild rice would have been dried. You could dry this hominy and carry it where it's actually dehydrated.
She adds in dried ramps, which are dehydrated wild onions harvested from the forest.
The other thing that I'm going to add a little bit of is some black pepper.
Once the hominy is added, she says it doesn't take long before it's ready to serve.
That's it. We're ready to roll here. I'm going to get a bowl.
The dish reminds her of the summer she spent on her grandpa's farm in Fond du Lac. She and her brother would play in grain bins filled with field corn that would be used as feed for dairy cows. Her husband has been going to Walpole Island to haul bags of corn for processing for years.
And they have community harvesting events. So they'll go out and the tribe will just cut all the corn down, and you go out and you just haul away whatever corn your family needs for the year.
She says she feels good that her kids get to grow up eating traditional foods like this.
These foods are their favorite things because these are their home-cooked meals, and that's like what I really like, that they get to keep those food traditions alive.
Not only that, she says they hear stories of where these dishes came from and see how they're made from start to finish.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story. It's part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions, a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity. Find more stories at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 45 years after her cousin was killed in a car bombing in Milwaukee, journalist Mary Spacuzza examines the unsolved murder of her family member they called Augie and the effects of organized crime on Milwaukee through generations. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you start by sharing a little about your cousin's life? Who was Augie Palmisano?
Sure. So he was a tavern owner and a fruit vendor on what was known as Commission Row in the Third Ward. That was a stretch of Broadway that now has a lot of upscale restaurants and boutiques and things like that. But at the time, it was really a working-class Sicilian, primarily Sicilian and Italian neighborhood that was packed with a lot of fruit vendors and some bars like Augie's. He also got involved in gambling and bookmaking and got into some trouble with the law through that, but also caught the attention of organized crime that wanted a cut of those profits.
He died from a car bombing in 1978. Why decide decades later to investigate his murder?
I've wondered that many times myself. I think for a long time, there was just a lot of silence and fear and shame around organized crime, and fear that it was just something we didn't talk about. And from a very young age, it clearly really troubled my father, but he didn't want to talk about it. So he would just say things like, don't fall in with the wrong crowd. You know what happened to Cousin Augie. Don't gamble. Look what happened to Cousin Augie. And as a young child, I had no idea what had happened to Cousin Augie. I just knew it was something bad and something that I wasn't supposed to ask about or talk about. So I only found out quite a long time later what had actually happened to him, which was a really brutal bombing at an apartment complex on like the northern edge of downtown Milwaukee that really could have done far more damage to the city if it had not been in an underground parking garage. And it was just something that I had always really bothered me, and something that was just this huge traumatic event that there was just a lot of silence around.
As I was reading your pieces, you know, news coverage, it's often described as the first draft of history. And I just wonder, what did you learn from looking through the paper archives and the coverage in the aftermath of that deadly explosion in 1978?
A few things. I thought, you know, obviously, I relied heavily on the work of some of my some of the folks who used to work at the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Sentinel, most notably investigative reporter Mary Zahn, and some of my colleagues from years past who did phenomenal work. I will say, I think it made me reflect a lot on the way we cover homicide victims. And there were some unnamed police officials quoted shortly after his murder saying he was a substantial figure in organized crime and things like that. And it made me think about, gosh, what do I say about a homicide victim, especially in the aftermath of a murder? And made me really reflect on trying to make sure I'm not doing any victim blaming or making it sound like this was someone who was murdered who had it coming. So I thought a lot about that and kind of reflected on my own coverage. I think the first draft was very thorough, but I do think that there were some sources who, you know, kind of had something to gain from portraying my cousin in a certain way and leaked that information or shared that information to reporters. And I think it's always good to think about what people's agenda are when they're, you know, sharing information. Not that it's bad to be an anonymous source. I use them all the time, clearly, but it's just made me think about some things differently.
You still had anonymous sources in this story generations later, generations removed from this. Why do you think that was?
Yeah, I did talk to some people who said, well, I think I'd be pretty safe talking to you, but I do have to think about the safety of my kids and my grandkids. And, you know, honestly, I didn't judge them at all. I get it. I think many of us grew up with just this fear and silence and fear that you don't want to be next. And quite a few people said the bombing was to send a message and to send a message that you don't talk about organized crime. You don't stand up to somebody who's seen as a boss. And I think I don't blame people for being afraid. Who would want that to happen to somebody in their family or themselves?
How active is organized crime in Milwaukee today?
That is also a good question. I think the case against Frank Balistrieri really did kneecap or really severely curtail organized crime here. I think that things like the RICO statutes and these FBI agents that I interviewed who really called it a full court press after Augie was killed, where they were really digging in, the police were digging in. I think it has been extremely curtailed, but I would never say that organized crime is gone. And it's clearly not only the vast majority of Sicilians are not involved in organized crime, and it is certainly not only among Sicilians or Italian Americans. So I think that there's still crime and organized crime out there. But I also didn't want to be too afraid to talk about it.
Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her latest probe examining organized crime in Milwaukee through the lens of the unsolved murder of her cousin Augie in a 1978 car bombing in Milwaukee. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A series of reports by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative journalist Mary Spacuzza. It puts a spotlight on the Milwaukee Mafia and the personal connection to examining organized crime in her hometown. Her cousin Augie was murdered in an unsolved car bombing over 45 years ago. Call in with a question. Share your insights. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mary, you mentioned Frank Balistrieri. While examining the murder of your cousin, can you explain Frank and what you've been learning about the presence of the mafia in Milwaukee?
Sure. So Frank Balistrieri was involved in a lot of different businesses, whether his name was on the license or not. He had nightclubs, bars, restaurants, dinner theater, also involved in some boxing and concert promotions. And he was, not that they put out a press release when he was picked as this, but he was the head or considered the boss of organized crime in Milwaukee for decades, really. And he was involved as far back from the FBI reports that I could see as the 1950s, even stretching back to the 1940s, but really was seen as the boss starting in the early 60s and stretching until he was sent to prison in the 1980s. And there was a huge case, or I think they called it the World Series of Trials here, where a prosecutor named John Franke prosecuted him and some of his associates for gambling, for extortion. And then he was sent to Kansas City for a massive trial about casino skimming. And that was something that he was also deeply involved in. And at a certain point, when he was in charge, the FBI documents detailed how he and others decided that anyone who was doing gambling or bookmaking, including some who just owned restaurants, but he wanted people to pay a cut of their profits to him, sometimes a very substantial cut. And sent out people who were known as his enforcers, according to all these FBI documents, to collect for him. And it was pretty well understood that you were supposed to pay a cut of those profits to him or you would be in trouble.
Did Frank Bellastri have anything to do with Augie's murder?
That is the widely held belief, is that my cousin's murder was carried out on the orders of Frank Ballastieri for a variety of reasons, and some of the reasons detailed in the FBI reports and some of the comments made to police officers at the time were that Frank said to an undercover FBI agent at Snugs that my cousin was arrogant. He said he called him a name to his face, and then he added, "And now they can't find his skin." Which is just a really chilling thing. I can't imagine ever saying that about somebody, and it's really just a disturbing thing to see said about a relative or anyone. It's also believed that Augie refused to kind of kowtow to Frank Ballastieri and pay a cut of his gambling taxes or gambling proceeds. There was also bad blood from them dating back to a marriage of a relatives, and some of the FBI documents went into that too. At one point, there was an argument between them, and Frank was overheard threatening Augie and saying that he was going to, I believe the quote was, chop him up and write his name in blood, which again is just a horrifying thing to say to anyone.
Then there was this bomb, this extremely deadly, forceful bomb that went off in the parking garage of this apartment building. What is known about how it was built, how it came to be? Was there an investigation into that?
Some of the FBI agents and the retired bomb squad detective who I spoke to talked about overkill bombs. And the idea of an overkill bomb is to create a force, like a forceful blast that is so powerful it really destroys any and all evidence that could be left behind, is certain to kill the victim. And also, people talked about wanting to send a message, and a bomb that would send a message to others of basically do as you're told, or you will end up like this. So it was an extremely forceful bomb that not only essentially destroyed the entire front half of my cousin's car and killed him, it also damaged 28 cars around him in the parking garage, underground parking garage. But some of the investigators I talked to said that had the bomb not gone off right away, if it had been out in the open, if he was driving down the street in downtown Milwaukee, that the damage could have extended several city blocks, which is again just a terrifying thing that to think that that could have happened right in, my hometown and our city.
You examine the history of the Third Ward in Milwaukee. How different is that neighborhood today from the 1970s?
It's so different. I don't know that my grandparents or great uncles and aunts or even some of my older uncles and aunts would have recognized it. It was, really working class. A lot of people like Augie, my grandfather, some of my great uncles would be up at, 2 a.m., 4 a.m. Often the produce deliveries would come in at 4 a.m. They'd check it out, get ready to do their wholesale. And it was almost like a 24/7 operation of fruit and other produce coming and going. Very, it used to be a working class community where a lot of first the Irish, then predominantly Italian and Sicilian moved when they came here. That's where my grandparents lived when they came here from Sicily. It was not what it is now. Now it's, obviously a beautiful neighborhood, lots of galleries, boutiques, restaurants, much more upscale than it was. Obviously, there was a church. It was nicknamed the Little Pink Church, Blessed Virgin of Pompeii, which a lot of the old timers talk about as what was like the heart and soul of the Italian and Sicilian community that was destroyed and demolished for the freeway, back in the 1960s. But I wish I could go back and see what it was like because I've only heard stories.
We have Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Mary Spicuzza with us. Mary, are you at peace with what you were able to uncover about Augie?
Yes and no. I think it was encouraging to hear. I'm still hearing from readers or people who knew Augie, what just tales of some of his kindness and some of the things that he did for members of the community. That's been really encouraging. I think I was a little afraid of what I might find. I kept asking, different FBI agents and investigators. He wasn't violent, right? Did he hurt anybody? Did he kill anybody? You just want to make sure that because I, as a reporter, I have to be transparent and report what I find. So in a lot of ways, I felt very relieved and feel very at peace of just hearing stories about his kindness and some of the things that he would do to help people. I think I would still love to get more answers about what had happened, and we're hoping to do a podcast and do some follow-up reporting. So some answers are still coming in, but I do feel at peace that in some way I feel like I hope my parents and Augie are in heaven, and I hope that they're proud of that I was able to set the record straight a bit on who Augie was and who he wasn't.
And really quickly here, you do then have a forthcoming podcast on your reporting about Augie and organized crime in Milwaukee?
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. Well, we'll leave it on those words. Mary, thank you for joining us and for sharing this really difficult story for you.
Thanks so much.
Mary Spicuzza is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin's largest solar project is fully operational. Wisconsin Public Service says the 830,000 solar panels move and track the sun throughout the day, maximizing power generation and providing enough energy to power roughly 90,000 homes. As we examine the future of solar, call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Hyla is Executive Director of Midwest Renewable Energy Association, which is based in Custer, Wisconsin, working with organizations on solar energy education and market development. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And we have Larry Susskind with us, professor of urban and environmental planning at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, founded the Consensus Building Institute. Larry, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Larry, starting with you, as we see our country having this boom in solar energy farms, as solar, you know, becomes more affordable and concerns about climate change are growing, but we're also seeing these conflicts bubbling up over where to place these solar farms. What is causing these conflicts?
It's not so much where to place them that people are fighting about. It's once decisions are made about where they're going to go, how big they're going to be, what the technology is, and all the other details, then they're announced. And people are finding out that the developers have made on the proposals that really ignore the adverse effects. And there are adverse effects on a small number of people. And the question is, should the rest of us say, well, too bad, some people are going to be adversely affected? Or should we have a discussion at the beginning as people are thinking about where and how to design these and say, who's going to be adversely affected and how can we hold them harmless? How can we mitigate or compensate the adverse effects? And in most states, the siting process doesn't start a conversation early enough so that people who are worried that something bad's going to happen to them have no choice but to be against the facility. That could be avoided.
It could be avoided if there was early buy-in in the process and that any shortcomings would be acknowledged and figured out much earlier on?
Yes, and I think that we have examples of what we call community benefit agreements, negotiated terms what the developer promises to help the community cover the costs that are created for it locally, usually for a big facility in a rural area. They're building the facility so that people in the city who are quite a ways away can have a lower cost clean energy. That's great, except they're leaving the costs on the individuals without having a discussion about how they could be minimized.
So, Nick, as you hear this, where do you see resistance to solar farms in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think Professor Susskind makes good points. I think it's important to understand that, you know, the solar, large-scale solar development doesn't result from some sort of intensive centralized planning process. And it's mostly driven by developers who are using their information as to where there's capacity in the grid, where there's flat land, where there may be willing landowners, and to points made previously, all of this happens for the most part out of public eye, and so these projects do come as a surprise often to local communities. It should be noted, in every state in the Midwest now, with recent legislation passed in Michigan and also Illinois, every state now, the Public Utility Commission is responsible for the approvals of these facilities and much of the local control of where and how they're sited has been now brought to the state capitol with appointed regulators. There are methods by which communities can engage in this process to maximize benefit, as was mentioned, with joint development agreements or community benefit agreements. And to get more, I guess, specifically to your question, where you see resistance, you know, these facilities bring really remarkable economic benefits to the local townships and counties where they're sited through energy tax revenue that's distributed, and that's quite significant. In Wisconsin, it's, you know, every facility that's 50 megawatts or bigger. And thinking of, you know, solar farm size, 1 megawatt is about 5 to 6 acres. And so you think about a 50 megawatt facility, you know, you're looking at a relatively significant amount of acreage. And it also brings revenue to the landholders where the farm is sited, and that can be very consistent and high per acre revenue for over 40 years. And so it's not often the farmers or landowners where the farm is sited that are resisting. It's more the neighboring landowners that aren't receiving the direct benefit.
Who don't have direct interests in it.
Right.
Yeah, economic impacts. Nick Hyla at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, Larry Susskind at MIT, as we talk about solar farms in Wisconsin and beyond, and hear from you. Call in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Larry, The Atlantic, in an article, faults environmentalists and civic groups for demanding too much public review on clean energy projects and causing delays in decarbonization. Are review processes like the public service commissions at large, are they causing holdups in approving solar energy?
I think that's silly. We've studied more than 53 instances of projects that have been stopped from one end of the country to the other. We're looking at all kinds of renewable energy projects. And when we got up close and looked at why those were delayed or blocked, it's because nobody bothered to take account of significant issues. Tribes were not consulted. There's a law that says if you're building on tribal land, the tribe has to be consulted. They weren't. So the people designing these facilities, usually from away, looking at a map and looking at, you know, solar or wind resources, picked a spot that happened to be sacred area. So, of course, the tribe is going to cause delay because it was nobody talked to them early. The delay is the product of most of our state siting laws not requiring a serious conversation, not a hearing after decisions are made, but a conversation before decisions are made. We have a clinic at MIT that we offer free assistance to communities. We worked in Michigan in the fall on two large solar projects. The end result of one of those projects was the municipality used its zoning power to try to keep the project out because too many people were going to be paying costs that nobody talked to them about, the issues of infrastructure and water. And while I agree with Nick that some landowners are going to be really happy because they can rent or sell their property and make more than they were making with whatever they were growing, as he pointed out, all the surrounding landowners aren't getting anything. And if there's going to be a loss of property value with the industrialization, as some people say, of what was a purely rural area, or certainly the visual impact if they don't put appropriate barriers around it for people that live in a place, or effects on the water supply. We just had a case this week in Massachusetts where a solar facility high on a hill, believe it or not, was cut down all the trees, getting ready to put in their equipment. And there was a big rainstorm, and nobody had created any retention ponds that worked. And all the water came pouring down the hill because the trees weren't there to the root take responsibility for stopping that. And it completely flooded the whole community at the bottom. And the developer says, hey, look, we have our license. We're allowed to build here. That's crazy. There's the delay that's a product of an effort to stop because nobody will listen or respond. The notion that Michigan then passed a law like New York and California, again, as Nick suggested, preempting all local involvement for large-scale facilities. Well, we haven't had the first instance yet of the state hearing that's going to take the place of all the local involvement that there was. I don't think it's going to stop the delay. I think, as Nick implied, they're going to just move the resistance in a more sophisticated way to the state level.
Larry Susskind, urban and environmental planning professor at MIT. Nick Hyla is with us as well, heads up the Wisconsin-based Midwest Renewable Energy Association, as we discuss solar energy's evolution, where to put it. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Nature Conservancy cites over half of large businesses and employers across five Midwest states, including Wisconsin. They have ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets, but they may be challenged without additional local renewable options. We examine the outlook for solar, and you can call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Larry Susskind is an urban and environmental planning professor at MIT and heads up the Consensus Building Institute. Nick Hyla leads the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Nick, we heard from Sandy in Lake Geneva, called in to ask, can the land around the panels on these solar farms be used to grow crops? What are the options?
Yeah, that's a growing field of research with some significant efforts even at the UW-Madison researching that. And I think the short answer is not yet. And maybe backing up a little bit, these decisions don't exist in a vacuum, right? As we are in this situation all across the United States where we are seeing how expensive it is to continue to own and operate much of our baseload generation, nuclear and coal. These facilities are at the end of their life, and the decisions of the Public Utility Commission based on cost and reducing cost of ratepayers have really focused on solar and wind energy development because the fuel is free and it's mostly an investment in steel and not in securing limited fossil fuel supplies throughout the life of the system. That represents a tremendous opportunity as we distribute these energy facilities across the landscape because these facilities bring revenue to communities that are desperately in need. But at the same time, they don't necessarily engage in a way that is transparent and open and collaborative with those communities to best site the farms. One obvious idea is to integrate them with agricultural practices, but the challenge there is you're taking this capital-intensive, calcified industry known as agriculture and trying to integrate it with another capital-intensive and calcified industry known as energy that have a lot of different layers of regulation and financing and infrastructure development. And it's absolutely feasible to integrate. Grazing is much more common under solar farms, and we're seeing that all across Wisconsin integrated. We're also seeing pollinator-friendly habitat, and that is part of this community benefits agreement process. For example, is you could require a developer to develop perennial grasses and wildflowers that prevent erosion and provide wildlife habitat. But crop production under large-scale solar facilities is a little more difficult, but very promising. And so I would say now you're not seeing a lot of it, but a lot of conversations are happening about the benefits there.
Feasible, but very complicated going forward. This month, Nancy from Wautoma called into us and expressed concern about large solar farms being developed on farmland.
There are huge tracts of farmland, huge. Mm-hmm. And there are two of them just within a couple of miles of each other that just went up in the Wautoma area. And we want to know why it had to go on farmland, why they can't use alternative sites.
Larry, should solar farms be put on buildings or over parking lots rather than on farmland?
It's a different kind of solar energy. Rooftop solar should go ahead. There are communities around the United States where you have publicly sponsored building on public building rooftops, and then that's extended to commercial and residential structures. But that scale is way different from what 1,000 acres and an industrial scale solar site is going to give you. And if you need a lot of land, it's not going to be in the city. It could be that land is reused, right? Navajo is trying to build large-scale solar facilities on abandoned coal mines. They're trying to make a new positive use. And apropos of the previous caller, they're trying to combine the raising of sheep of the kind that have wool that they use to make the special Navajo blankets by having the sheep maintain, as Nick implied, keeping the grass or whatever's growing low so that the sheep herders have a way of generating some income. But coordinating that, as Nick pointed out, is no simple matter. That's why this community benefit agreement idea that both Nick and I mentioned very briefly really needs to be spelled out in state siting law. The new Michigan law says really just a couple of lines, and it says the developer should try to talk to the community and work something out and write a community benefits agreement. And if they show that they tried to talk to some local people and nobody wanted to talk to them, that's good enough. That's ridiculous. Every state siting law should be amended to require a community-wide conversation where the product is a contract that's signed between the local government and the developer and is submitted as part of the plan and thus becomes enforceable by the state siting council. And if you know that you have to have a community benefits agreement that seeks to meet the interests of all sides, those difficult negotiations will happen early, and they'll happen in a way that takes account of needs and interests that are being ignored. But there's no question that the largest of these facilities are going to be in rural areas because they need a huge amount of space and they want to get that land at the lowest cost they can. But it could be that reused land that was not good for anything else anymore, for whatever reason, could be the first choice within a larger region.
Larry Susskind there at MIT, Nick Hyla with us at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association as we talk about solar energy. Let's go to Bonnie in Deer Park. Bonnie, hi.
Hello. I am wondering...
Hi, Bonnie. Can you hear us?
Hi.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering how long a solar panel's life is, and then once it's no longer used, how is it recycled?
Thank you, Bonnie. How long does this technology last, Nick?
Yeah, so a typical solar module has a production warranty of 25 years, but are expected to last 30 to 40. If you look at the land lease agreements that are currently being signed across the Midwest, you're looking at 40-year agreements, so kind of like a expected 40-year lifespan. There's a lot of misinformation out there about, the contents of a solar module and whether it's recyclable. So maybe we'll just address that quickly.
Very quickly, yes.
Yeah, modules are basically glass, aluminum, copper, and plastic. They're very simple, and polysilicon, which is the electricity producing part of the module. And right now there's research all across the country and very successful processes to basically strip those modules apart into their reusable components. And that is a priority in the industry. So we are seeing and expect to see as these facilities are installed. And again, this is often part of the decommissioning requirements of these plans is to disassemble recycle these modules. So it is a priority for the industry, and we're seeing a lot of progress there.
Nick Hyla, their executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, as we continue this conversation. And thank you to Larry Susskind, environmental planning professor at MIT. Larry, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Midwest states are leading boldly on renewable energy, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council. But Midwest grid operators have more work to do to align the grid with clean energy. As we examine the path forward for solar projects, call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Hyla is here, Executive Director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association that is based in Wisconsin. So, Nick, stepping back for a moment, what is the regulatory approval process in Wisconsin for solar farms?
Yeah, so we have what's called a site and acquire process, which is somewhat unique, and that most of these projects are developed by private developers with a handshake agreement with the utility to assume control and ownership of the project once complete. And so that developer comes up with a plan. They surely need to meet with the county boards and local townships and conform to local planning and zoning rules. You know, not all developers are created equally. So some developers are very good at developing joint development agreements that provide good neighbor payments to landowners, fund scholarship programs, fund education programs at local schools, donate panels to local municipalities, do all of the things that help build local support, which is, I guess, necessary or, you know, probably a good move on a developer's part, because the Public Service Commission then goes through a approval process that includes public comment and review, that requires full plans be set and a vote from a majority of commissioners to approve the projects. There have been instances in Wisconsin and in neighboring states in Minnesota where the commission has said, no, you know, you need to do a little more work to get more local support before we approve this project. But for the most part, all of the projects have been pretty swiftly approved.
But there has been litigation in this area of solar farms. The proposed 300-megawatt Koshkonong solar farm in Dane County that would cover more than 2,000 acres. And there's also been objections to a 250-megawatt farm in Portage County. What problems are coming up with, these types of Wisconsin projects?
Yeah, I don't know that there's problems per se. Mm-hmm. I think there are concerns. You know, these facilities are, there's no moving parts. They're pretty close to the ground. I think they're not very visible for the most part. They're not a major, like a large wind turbine. They're not kind of a visual obstruction in the landscape. I think mostly it's just the change and misunderstanding. And, you know, there is resistance, but, you know, what you'll see is that the majority of comments submitted are relatively supportive. I think there's just concerns that local concerns aren't being met, that property values might be affected, that farmland will come out of production. But, you know, the challenge right now is that those county boards and local townships and stakeholders that are best organized and best have planned for this development, have updated their planning and zoning to accommodate and incentivize these facilities to be put in certain locations, that are engaged, that are prepared to negotiate. Those jurisdictions are getting the best deal. And so I think, you know, a message for your listeners is really that, you know, it had been, you know, Wisconsin doesn't have shale oil reserves. We're not like Pennsylvania or Wyoming or North Dakota. But if we were, every single local jurisdiction would have been prepared to ensure that the developers of those oil and gas resources protect the local environment, maximize economic development, and reduce local impact. Now everybody sits under the sun. And so it's very important for jurisdictions to realize that these projects are coming. They provide a tremendous economic development opportunity, and they provide public participation risk, and that risk needs to be managed and leveraged in many instances for the maximum benefit to local people for this, these new developments.
Let's bring on a call. Timothy in Madison. Timothy, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, good morning. You're having a really interesting discussion. And I guess my concern is natural resources. And Wisconsin may not have oil or shale, but Wisconsin has got natural resources. And that's my concern. And two things. One, you know, they talk about some of these areas, wastelands. Well, for instance, in central Wisconsin, we've got a lot of good grasslands there. And there's the prairie chicken land, which that's a threatened species in Wisconsin. And there are some proposals to put in solar panels over these grasslands. And what will that do to the prairie chickens and the natural the wildlife that's there? That's one of my concerns. But then also the transmission of the power. You know, these power lines, when they have to get the power from a regular power station or the solar, the power lines, the power line people go in during the summer in July, August. They're mowing and they're mulching the native species that are underneath there. And if we're concerned about things like monarchs, the milkweed, that's where the only thing that monarchs, which are proposed possibly for an endangered species, that they lay their eggs on. And so they interrupt that. And what we need is for the power line companies, I think, to be working with the private landowners to encourage them to get that land in prairie species, and they would be less maintenance, and it would really be good for wildlife. In fact, there's going to be a question on that this spring in the Conservation Congress hearings in April. Every citizen in Wisconsin can vote on a question, which is saying that they shouldn't be mowing during the summer, and also then they should work with the private landowners. What we need...
And Timothy, I just want to jump in here and have Nick say a few words on understanding the full health of an ecosystem as to where you place solar and how you maintain solar farms.
Yeah, those are all good points. You know, I think backing up a bit, you know, our energy use has consequences. We are the most energy wasteful nation on Earth per capita. We use a tremendous amount of energy. We take that use for granted, and that there are consequences to that. These decisions don't exist in a vacuum. You know, we are transitioning. You know, the general political diatribe is that somehow wind and solar development is killing coal-fired power plants. That's not true. Natural gas development is what's threatened the profitability of coal plants. So has just the increased expense of owning and operating coal facilities. We're retiring coal plants all across the country. The average age of our nuclear fleet is over 40 years old, and wind and solar are by far the cheapest electrons on the grid. In that context, the question becomes, should we be a nation of not in my backyard? Should we pretend that we can enjoy all of the benefits of our electricity and energy privilege without any of the consequences? I think the answer is very clearly no, and people need to accept that. Now, can we develop these facilities in a way that maximize wildlife benefit and minimize harm? Absolutely. We know how to do it. There are guidelines for pollinator-friendly and wildlife-friendly solar installations, as well as wind facilities. The Nature Conservancy and others have looked at this very intensively. And all of that is easily done, again, through community engagement and requirements for the development of these facilities to be sensitive to these situations, and including with the prairie chicken habitat in central Wisconsin. All of this is integrated quite easily. I would make a point, you know, that there's a lot of hand-wringing over the loss of farmland, which I understand, but nearly half of all of the corn production in Wisconsin is corn ethanol. That's not food. That's energy. And corn ethanol is a net loser for energy in to energy out. A recent study commissioned by Clean Wisconsin looked at the energy productivity of a solar facility as compared to corn ethanol. and it's 10 times as energy productive. It has 10 times the energy return on investment as corn ethanol. No groundwater pollution, no fertilizer requirements, no pesticides, no herbicides. And so there are real positive benefits of solar development. But again, this isn't going to be gifted to us. This, you know, the future belongs to people who organize and intelligently engage to maximize the benefit of these type of investments.
Nick Hyla with us, Executive Director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, that is based in Wisconsin, as we discuss the solar energy future, installations, and solar companies. You can join in. Questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, you know, Wisconsin residents paid tens of thousands of dollars for solar systems from Sun Badger Solar, and WPR is reporting the company stopped operations last year, leaving many customers with nothing to show for their money. Has that company's failure damaged the potential for solar power?
I would say yes. You know, solar is a referral business. It's really solar adoption is related to proximity and affinity. If your neighbor gets solar and has a good experience, then you're likely to. If someone that goes to your church or someone that's, parent that you go to sports with, goes solar and they have a good experience, then you're likely to. And the same is true for bad experiences. And companies like Sun Badger give the industry a bad name. You know, we are a member association of over 2,000 members across the Midwest. Many of them work in the energy industry, are solar installers. We know what quality solar installations look like. And so it's really important from a consumer standpoint to make sure that you're getting what you pay for. And consumer protection is really a big priority of ours now because, you know, in this context of the conversation, you know, not all solar is created equal. As Professor Susskind was saying, you know, these large-scale solar farms are transmission-connected, they're utility-owned, and they basically serve as baseload power that sends electricity into the grid, which we purchase as ratepayers. Rooftop solar, backyard solar, customer-owned solar, that's solar that we own. That directly offsets the electricity we purchase. No utility owns it. No utility investor gets their rate of return off of it. This extends the investment into our electricity system to anybody that has a home or business or land with a suitable site. And these assets serve as energy efficiency. They actually deter the construction of new solar farms because the less electricity we use in the distribution system and the more smartly we can use it and control the way that we use electricity, the less we have to build and the less we have to pay for. The utilities have to build and the less ratepayers have to pay for it. So it's absolutely critically important that in this competitive open market where any home or business can pursue a solar investment, that we ensure that those investments are long-lasting and that those customers are well-served.
Nick Hyla leads the Wisconsin-based Midwest Renewable Energy Association as we discuss solar power. Call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore major increases in solar generation nationwide and capacity on the electric grid with dozens of solar companies in Wisconsin, according to Renew Wisconsin. Nick Hyla is Executive Director of Midwest Renewable Energy Association. Let's go to Frank now in La Crosse. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. So my comments parallel Nick's comments. I think everybody's talked about the problems of siting in rural areas, either wind farms or solar farms, because of the loss of land and then the transmission of the power generated by either type of facility to the urban and suburban areas. And currently, the Public Service Commission is allowing these utility companies through the transmission companies to charge ratepayers instead of stockholders. So my suggestion is, as Nick suggested, put the power generation in the hands of the private owners. And my suggestion, there's a lot of warehouse space in urban and suburban areas. Those large rooftop areas are sitting there just asking for an alternative income generation for their real estate business. So the program should generate incentives to site solar power on these rooftops of these large urban suburban warehouse roofs. That way the power is right there and you've generated additional income for the real estate owners and you don't have the problems of using up rural land and charging ratepayers for transmission.
Frank,
and that's the way that the Public Service Commission currently favors the corporate energy generators as opposed to ratepayers.
Frank, thank you for calling in and sharing that scenario and suggestion. Let's now go to Elizabeth in Eau Claire. Elizabeth, what is your idea?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm actually traveling down the interstate listening to the show, and I'd like to comment so far. But the logistics of starting a huge solar farm that takes up many, many acres has got to be kind of nightmarish in getting the power from the solar panels to the grid to disseminate it to public use. Also, road accesses have to be made, and it's a big endeavor. We already have probably thousands of acreage in between the northbound and southbound lanes on the interstate where the land and environment's already been disrupted. Why don't we put the solar panel farm right down the middle of the interstate? There's a power grid up and down there. There's already lines that can be lagged onto. It won't further disrupt the environment. There's huge road access, lots of acreage already government-owned. Put it down the middle of the interstate in between the north and southbound lanes.
Elizabeth, thank you as well. Nick Hyla, what comes up as you hear about interstate median panel solar farms and warehouse panel incentives?
Yeah, the biggest return on investment for our state and for ratepayers in general, which we all pay an electricity bill, whether that's embodied in the goods that we use or directly, is facilitating customer investments in the distribution system that produce the electricity where it's used and that make the distribution system smarter, right? Our grid has had, for the last 100-plus years, one simple operating parameter, which is supply must equal demand or failure occurs. And we have, to date, not invested significantly in managing our demand and instead have overbuilt capacity to make sure that we can supply this variable uncontrolled demand, and we pay for all that extra capacity. Now we have the opportunity with rooftop solar and batteries and energy efficiency and electrification to better manage the demand and to better leverage private investments in the distribution system, and that needs to be a public policy priority across the country if we're going to reduce costs over the long term. When it comes to some of these more innovative investments, we are trapped by our past infrastructure investments. We're trapped by the way we've built them and the debts we've owed. And nothing was built to accept solar. We have a difficult time just building and operating roads, much less solar roads. And so I think it's a very innovative idea, but I wouldn't say that it's the lowest hanging fruit here. Warehouse roofs, absolutely. Parking lots, definitely. Landfill sites and Superfund sites should have solar. Unusable land that's close to energy infrastructure, absolutely. And so I think with looking at our energy future, the amount of energy that we use, the amount of electricity we'll use throughout the future, this is an all-hands-on-deck effort. It's also a tremendous opportunity to rebuild the fundamental underpinnings of our economy in a way that is more open and more beneficial and more distributed. And I think that there are a lot of ways to do that, but probably, well, absolutely, the highest return on investment is helping ratepayers themselves, homes and businesses, do it for themselves.
So what could the Wisconsin governor, Governor Evers, and the legislature do to encourage more investment in solar energy and be in the ballpark of achieving net zero emissions by 2050?
Well, I guess the question is, what do the executive and legislative branches ever do together nowadays? I think, you know, we need a clear and shared vision. One interesting bill is a community solar bill that's in committee. It's actually introduced and sponsored by Republicans. I have a feeling that if it would ever get out of committee and get a vote, it would actually attract quite a bit of support across the aisle and get a signature from Governor Evers. And what that bill would allow is for private development of smaller scale solar facilities, 5 megawatts or less, and businesses to invest directly in them and get the benefits of the electricity production mediated on their electricity bill. This has been a tremendous economic boom for the Twin Cities in Minnesota, with over 800 megawatts of community solar being developed and the vast majority of it serving business customers that not only get to reduce their electricity bills, but market their net zero electricity and all do it within their business service territory. Businesses in Wisconsin are clamoring for it. The Wisconsin Grocers Association is a big supporter. And so there are opportunities here where we could see some bipartisan support for bills that really open up Wisconsin's economy for advantageous local clean electricity development.
Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nick Hyla is Executive Director of Midwest Renewable Energy Association. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Courtney Everett, Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, Joel Patnod, Royce Padeswa, Avery Rogers, and Joe Tarr. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Keegan Kyle is interim executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.